What I'm going to do is explain a little bit about the place that I lead at Tyndale House in Cambridge. And God's blessed us over a number of years, and a number of things have gone right because of his blessing. And it's really important when we look at the Bible to see how that happens. I was saying to people recently, Genesis chapter 15 is a place where Abraham shows this great faith, and then straight afterwards he's doubting God. And when you look at the life of David, you see how David does some right things, but he does an awful lot wrong, and God blesses him anyway. And over the 15 or so years I've been leading Tyndale House, it does seem to have been blessed. I mean, in human terms, it's gone from 8 to 25 staff, which, you know, in human measurements would seem like it's going well. But we're told that those who are given much, much will be required of them. And one of the things that I slightly fear is the question where we are relative to what might have been. I don't mean in size, but in terms of blessing, because I actually think I'm one of the most privileged people on the planet. I mean, I was given 8 years free university education. I've had five brilliant teachers. I had a stable home with loving parents who brought me up surrounded by books, and I've been able to spend the last 32 years studying things that are related to the language of the Bible, and so on. And that's a pretty huge privilege. And, you know, sitting next to someone who is in a war zone at lunchtime, realizing that, you know, being given an absolute lot. And so actually, when you then put that metric alongside whatever little success there might seem to have been, and it can be quite a scary thought as to what might have been. But God's very gracious, and God has blessed. So I just want to describe the organisation. Tyndale House is in Cambridge, England, and it's an academic organisation seeking to occupy the space of equipping the church with rigorous research that's also accessible, and bringing an academic biblical discourse. Just to give you a sense of what we've been given by God, this is West Cambridge. It's a very green area. It's lovely. It's beautiful. And just up here, you can see King's College Chapel there. That is an amazing, large, you know, Cambridge's most famous building. If you basically come about 800 metres west, that is Tyndale House, and we've got just over an acre and six buildings. It was bought for £4,500 back in 1944. Interestingly, before the Second World War ended, before D-Day, people in the UK looking to set up an evangelical research institution. And that's just a bit inside the main corridor of our library. It's absolutely stuffed with books, and I have the privilege of working with some absolutely amazing people. So giving you a really, really basic timeline, property was purchased in 1944. 1945 through to 2007, it has a gradually undulating growth. It goes through a couple of times of nearly shutting down and so on, and different emphases theologically, some good, some not as good. And then at 7707, whether you're using British or American counting, they appoint this 36-year-old leader who had never run an organization before or ever raised funds before. In fact, they asked me a question on the application form: have you ever raised funds, and if so? And I wrote about a failed application for an internal grant from Aberdeen University, and anyway, I still got the job. So that's an interesting thing. One of the problems I had early on was trying to be a visionary leader, and it can be shown that visionary leaders are usually bad for organizations. You know, there are some studies on this, and the reason why is because they have lots of ideas and no filters and discipline, or they can have ideas that aren't really in touch with reality. And as Bob Beale, how many of you met Bob Beale? Sometimes comes to the forum, says vision without implementation is delusion. And I come back to this saying again and again. It's a really important idea. A lot of us might imagine a future, and we imagine a future, say, I really want that future to happen. But unless there's some mechanism and steps for delivery, it just stays a delusion. It just stays in your mind. And it can actually be a huge distraction from doing something good, because you're spending all your time in this fantasy world of your delusion, your vision, rather than actually doing something good in the real world. And I certainly have fallen into that trap many times. So often when it came to buildings, we've got buildings and I wanted to expand the buildings or buy bigger buildings. And you can put lots of effort into trying to get bigger buildings. And unless there's actually some sort of step, it's just the approach to fundraising that imagines that fundraising is all about meeting some incredibly wealthy, let's say, American, who's going to drop you a seven-figure check, and then all your problems will be taken care of, where rather than thinking that fundraising is like what my daughter did when she was about four or five, and we were at a fairground, and turned to me and said, Dad, can I have a pound so I can go on that ride? And of course, it was a very realistic vision that she had of her going on that ride, and was realized because she had turned to someone with the means who loved her and would also enjoy her going on that ride and so on. So that's an area where I've, and I'll get a bit more specific after a while, but I've certainly had that when it's come to thinking in terms of fundraising and sizes of things. My predecessor had wanted to build a new library at Tinderhouse because our books go absolutely to the ceiling. And for at least the first 4 or 5 years, I had building a new library as a constant thing that I was bringing to the board, because I thought, we need a new library. You know, how are we going to get a new library? We still don't have a new library. We've been in it for 15 years. And I actually needed the board eventually to tell me, Pete, stop going on about a new library. Learn how to walk, then run, okay? And it was all this, you know, big vision, and I needed to actually go back a few steps. And that also was something important in fundraising. There are lots of generous people in the world. There are lots of people God has given means to. Many of the people who have got a lot of money are actually quite intelligent about money, surprisingly enough, and they can look at you and know that you're not very intelligent about money. You're someone who's got a PhD in Syriac, and that isn't particularly relevant. And so that was an interesting thing, because I would often go to people, and I wasn't afraid to ask. Thank you, as someone who's been coaching me in asking here. But actually, I didn't have a realistic plan. I had a printout on A4 of what I was going to do with this vast sum of money, but there wasn't a team that would deliver it. There wasn't anything like that. And it, even when I wasn't generally asking for seven-figure sums, I've got to say, I was often asking for things that are far less. But again, people could see that there was no mechanism for delivery. So then, if they had given the money, which they were smart enough not to do, then it would have not been well spent. It would have been really badly spent. We'll talk about spending money badly soon. Often what I wanted to do is take our program, and I wanted it to grow by vast amounts really quickly. And again, intelligent people I was speaking to shot that down. That's been a major problem. It's actually often been thinking, oh, and it's not just 1,000%. You know, I used to draw out papers about how we were going to go 20% a year or whatever it was. And again, these weren't numbers that came from anywhere realistic. They just simply come from my vision, but it was a delusional vision because it wasn't connected to reality. And I've actually seen lots of other folk produce these, you know, plans for the board. This is how we're going to grow. Our support base is going to grow at this rate, you know, 10, 20% per year. And like, how did you get these numbers? Where are they from? And that's what was certainly happening. And I think in the midst of all this, there is this delusional thinking in relation to us and God. God doesn't actually need us. He wants us to work. He doesn't need us to work at all. So an encouraging thing is this. Finally, we are in a better position in funding it in the House. And once we'd finally got into the position where we were ready to try and campaign for a new library, and I was about to start campaigning for a new library, an absolutely random person I had never heard of phoned up the secretary in the front office and asked to talk to me and then said, I would like to pay for a new library. So didn't have to do any of that work. But God wanted me ready to do that work and said, you know, his point was someone who visited your institution before you were born and hasn't been back since and doesn't really know you but does love your institution is going to do this. Okay, so it wasn't that you needed me. So one of the things I've learned over time is the real need for a team. If vision without implementation is a delusion, I also think vision without team is delusion. And that's something that I've learned the hard way. As a leader, often a leader of a small organization, some of you may be leader of an organization and you are the only person in that, then you have to be, well, you're supposed to do everything, but you can't do everything because you're a creature, you're a human. What you realize then is how, well, God can do everything, but God wants you not to do everything. God wants you to move, step forward one thing at a time. Now, you can have a GPS and it sets you off in the right direction, but without a vehicle, you won't go very far. So that's where vision might say this is the direction we're heading in, but unless there's a means of taking you along, you're not going to get very far. Likewise, if you have a vehicle without brakes, it won't get very far. It might seem to get far initially, but it's a bit of a problem. And so one of the things that someone taught me about, like once I've been leading the organization for about 8 years, was what they call stage gating. It doesn't matter about whether you use the word or not, but it's that you never, never, never take on a new initiative or plan until you have a process of getting that new initiative or plan checked out. Because what I would do is I'd actually exhaust people by coming into the office and say, I've just had a new idea. This is what we need to do. They were just recovering from your last idea, and their eyes glaze over, and you know, really? So you can exhaust people, you lose good staff, people get demotivated, because there are people who are prepared to follow vision. There are a lot of people who don't want to set vision themselves. I can think of some, you know, people very, very dear to me who say, they would never want to be an entrepreneur. They want someone to provide the framework and they will plug into that framework. There are those sort of people and then there are those who will lead. And some of you, you may have a very rare gift of being a really great number two in an organization. That is a wonderful thing and a huge blessing in God's kingdom. You're not a pushover. You give really strong feedback to a leader, but also, you're the person who works best as someone's right-hand man, right-hand person. So that's where having those filters has been really important. One of my filters is called Dirk Jonkind, and he's very good at saying, no, Pete, that's a stupid idea. Another one is Simon Sykes, who's been here many times, and he's number two in operations. Again, he's more polite and delicate than Dirk, but no less ruthless when it comes to the idea for me to ditch a plan. So this was something that was quite a problem for me, not actually having enough of a filter mechanism before we start putting time and energy into an idea, or some mechanism of working out how many things, how many balls can we be juggling at the same time. So that's where I spent large amounts of time with the core team. Dear Peter Luce here on the left, how many of you knew Peter now with the Lord? I met him on the bus coming back from ELF. And it was amazing because he was a businessman who retired age 45 and from steel and IT and all sorts of things, and then just spent his time helping good causes. And there was me just having arrived at Tyndale House, pouring out my heart about issues. And eventually, you know, he started volunteering, then came on the board. Eventually, he became chair for a number of years. And that made a huge difference to have that partnership. He used to come up and spend just about a day a week with us. So to have a free senior businessman put in the time, open his contact list, that was just an amazing partnership. To have. But that has been a really essential thing, and these three gentlemen saved me from a lot of mistakes that I would make. Bad use of funds. Quotation from Dirk Jonkin, it's easy to spend other people's money. It really is. I love spending other people's money. Giving out grants, I mean, it doesn't hurt you at all. And of course, governments love doing this. Politicians love doing this, spending other people's money. And that's where it can be quite easy not to control costs in a way that you would do if it was your own money. Now, of course, we should expect there to be a certain amount of waste, as in we all waste some of our own money. We buy something that actually doesn't turn out to be as useful and so on. That's because we don't know perfectly, you know, the future, things can, you know, go back and forth, and that's okay. And we should also recognize that governments will waste some money, a certain amount, and that's okay. Never try and get 100% efficiency, it's just not achievable. But beyond that, you can actually waste money. So early on, through the European Leadership Forum, I was introduced to a foundation which no longer exists, which actually gave us a grant, which was really nice. It was a grant in order to do some scholarship, which we called the Text and Canon Project. And it's about the text of the Bible and the canon of Scripture. And we thought what we're going to do is we're going to support a whole load of people to do some good work on this. Now, what I realized afterwards, and we gave out quite a few grants, is this did good, but didn't do as much good as that money could have done. Because what you could do is, you know, if you're giving out money, why would we not also ask for something back that feeds back into the organization? So a lot of foundations now have a line in their grant proposal stuff, which is, how did the last grant move the organization forward? So it's possible, rather than just, you know, someone will take a check and say, that's great, you've just helped me get my PhD, right? But what if you find a way whereby that person actually connects back into the organization and does stuff? And that was where I was naive and, you know, wasted tens of thousands of dollars, or wasted, didn't optimally use that. And then we decided we were going to create a website for this wonderful project, which is going to help, you know, defend the faith in the public. Well, you know, things about websites is they have ongoing costs, don't they? And it was a really great website for about a year. And then, you know, it just gradually, well, there wasn't more content coming in. It went back to the stage gating issue, that here it was an initiative that hadn't really been adequately thought through in terms of how sustainable it was. I also was inventing brands left, right, and center. So we had the Text and Canon Project brand, we had the Bible and Church Conference brand, and we were just inventing brands. People who know about branding know that, you know, you're just diluting what you're doing all the time, but there we are. So when you're desperate for funding, as we were, so just to give you an idea of the financial position at Tyndale House when I arrived, we had three monthly donors worldwide giving a total of £80, okay? We had a foundation that was regularly giving, but in terms of just normal monthly givers, almost nothing. And I poured out my heart, particularly into fundraising in the first year, and we ended up with our biggest ever deficit, £50,000. Now, that's on top of having had 14 years of deficit every single year leading up to that. So that was a pretty crunch point for the organization. It was a bit of a low, things did turn around. And one of the things that happens is, of course, you can't raise funds quickly. Funds can be raised quickly if, you know, people act, but you can't do anything that's going to make that happen, because fundraising is essentially about friend raising, and you can't make friends super quickly of a deep kind. So what I went to do is because people don't want to give for ongoing costs, they want to give for new and shiny things. And so I would invent a new project every year until you had so many projects going. Everyone was thoroughly exhausted. And what was happening is people were giving, I was asking people, can you give for this new and shiny project? That meant that the money was restricted. It was, the donors had said it is for the new shiny project. It's not just for general use. So what we ended up with is having pots of money that were for very specific purposes, and the general fund was doing really terribly. And it actually took a volunteer accountant who volunteered about 10 years of his life just to come up 2 days a week, retired accountant, who really turned things around and made us reconsider our accounts for 10 previous years and recharge things properly. But that was a big problem, that I was keep on coming up with new initiatives just in order to attract funds. You might not do that sort of thing, but that's what I was doing. And of course, one thing when you're not counting money well is you often forget how much time can be money. So if you work out how many, if we reckon on someone working 2,000 hours a year, right? That means you can very simply work from their hourly wage to their annual wage, if that makes sense. Their hourly wage is about half of their annual wage. Now, the annual wage is different from their employment cost, how much it actually costs to employ someone. But basically, let's say someone's paid 30,000 euros, and they're working 30,000 euros a year. They're working 2,000 hours a year, so that means they're getting 15 euros now, okay? But that means, roughly, every hour of theirs costs 30 euros, because usually in an organization, it's about double the salary costs to the actual operating costs. So you get this very simple system. They're paid 30,000 euros a year. Every hour of their time costs 30 euros. Okay, now let's have a staff meeting. How much money is being spent just having that staff meeting? And is that really helping things forward? As I say, it's easy to have to spend other people's money, and let's have a staff away day and plan and so on. Now, those things are all necessary, but I needed to count for those things, and often I didn't. Now, a big mistake I made being busy is letting relationships slip. I'm supposed to have a huge number of relationships just in my job. It's one of those things because I need to relate to the staff. I need to relate to the people we have in the community, like about 40 at a time. There are about 50 users in the library. There are our donors. There's our board. There's other people in other Christian organizations. There are academics in the university. There are people at ELF. All of those sort of relationships, which puts me in the unusual situation of trying and failing to try and have over 100 meaningful relationships a lot of time. And of course, that means it's really easy to let those slip because you can get busy with things. So our aim is to have a testimony in the university, one of the things, Cambridge University, great university on the whole, quite secularized university. I had a number of openings there, this is point three, that I just let drop because I was busy doing other things that seemed important. I've had openings with donors, point four, that again, I let slip because I, had the meeting with a person, I didn't follow up with an email within 24 hours and all this sort of thing. And what at first seemed like, this is quite a keen meeting and so on, just slipped. Now, that may be fine, but the point is I was doing this without planning it. It was just happening. I'm not very good at planning days. In fact, I generally don't plan my days, which is probably one of those things. Some of these are temperamental things. I do like to sort of see what happens sometimes. That's where, you know, it's essential for me if I have that particular weakness to try and build around people, meet people who will compensate for that weakness. I am not in any sense advocating not planning. I'm just confessing. Okay, so travel and time. It's really easy to overvalue or undervalue your own time. So overvaluing is thinking that, you know, God really needs you to do something. And God had Moses in the desert for 40 years, so that one of the things is Moses wouldn't overvalue his own time. That's one of the things behind the Sabbath principle. You stop for one day in seven, the world doesn't stop. It goes on. Wow. You know, get that. God can do things without you for a whole day, every week. So that's been one of those things about overvaluing your own time. And what signs of this can be just rushing from meeting to meeting, thinking it's really important to fill every minute, to, you know, be listening to podcasts all the time, to use those gaps in between, cutting short the amount of time you give to people. I remember early on meeting with some people who I thought were quite disrespectful because they, you know, gave 10-minute meetings and then were dashing off, and it didn't leave a good taste in the mouth. But I've probably, you know, done that in my own time as well. Then undervaluing my own time. I think sometimes you can do things that other people could do just as well, and you're not realizing you're, you know, investing a lot of time into this. This is not necessarily very useful. So there was someone who wrote quite a few people have put this in leadership books that, you know, the CEO, the leader, is supposed to spend all of their time on the things that are worth, and then they put in a figure. You know, I've read like $20,000. You know, that's what you've got to spend time. This is crazy. And the reason it's crazy is because it's based on secular values. It's not based on spiritual values. God wants us to use our time efficiently and to waste our time. Both of those, quite important, because part of it is recognizing that he is God, be still and know that I am God, as well as the need for the, you know, Paul, you know, working through sleepless nights for the kingdom. And those are both necessary. And often I've got the wrong thing at the time. I've not been staying close to God and in that. Traveling alone. I've spent over a year in the US raising, you know, funds, meeting friends. And in early days, I, you know, weren't really mobile phones much use in 2007. And I was, you know, traveling all alone. It's very tempting, go on your own. You know, lots of time away from your wife. And Lord kept me, but it's a really, really tough time. And I think it's something we should do what we can to avoid. Time in a car, having fellowship with someone, could be a really, really useful time. And what happens is, and there are so many stories about this, where people spend time on their own and they get overtired and then they're vulnerable. And that's when you're really vulnerable to temptation, and, you know, there aren't people around who can check up on you. So that's been a big issue early on. Nowadays, I'm got much better traveling arrangements, you know, more infrastructure and so on. And that's been a blessing. overfilling time. Like, how do you decide where to speak? Someone asked you, can you speak on Tuesday night? You look in your diary, not doing anything on Tuesday night. Yeah, sure, I can speak. And that's certainly the way I used to run things. And it's very foolish because it hasn't built in any preparation time. It hasn't built in any recovery time. If you've decided, you know, you're going to go straight back into something straight after being here at the forum, do you need any recovery time? after that. And sometimes you don't. I mean, there are energy levels that God can give people that are extraordinary, thinking of the George Verwer, who recently passed to glory, and how God gave him absolutely extraordinary levels of energy, and you know how he managed to read all those people's prayer letters that he said he was reading and write personal letters to people. D.A. Carson, a theologian, again, been blessed through many, many decades with just extraordinary levels of energy. But there are some real problems with overfilling time. And I, about 8 years in to leading, nearly burnt out. I don't know if I nearly burnt out because I was never, you know, properly psychologically assessed. It's just I felt extremely low. I'm someone who likes to research the Bible. And what had happened is I'd been spending so much time on organization that I was getting de-skilled in the core area that I felt called to do. And that was a very low time. God brought me out of that through what appeared to be some accidents and failure to acquire a building. I could tell you the story if you want, but it was it worked well. God brought me through that. So that's now, for some of you would have got this years ago, I'm 52, but we now got a system at Tyndale House where the board asked me not to do more than 5 overseas trips this year. And that's really helpful for the first time actually to have that sort of limit, because what that does is it means that, while we assess things, try and make sure that's really good use of time, rather than just tearing around thinking that God wants us to be headless chickens. I don't know if that's an expression in your countries, but you know, very crazy. And that's often when I was overfilling time, it's because your heart isn't full enough with Christ. So you're filling your time because you're trying to get meaning and fulfillment, recognition, these sort of things through that sort of busyness. And then there can be health consequences to that. And of course, family. So if I spent a year in the US raising funds, that's a year out of the 18 years that my children have been growing up. My son's 18 tomorrow, and I'm just going to get back in time. But I've missed most of his birthdays because of ELF. You know, so he does know that. But there's a cost to that. Have we counted that cost? Other people are partaking in that. So then going back to the vision, what's the vision? You know, well, I might have a huge vision for Tyndale House and you might have a huge vision for your organization. What's the cost of that vision? Who's paying the cost to that? So, and then bad personal priorities. So often prioritizing work over family. You know, your parents have only got one dad or mum. Prioritizing work over church and personal ambition. I've got to say, this is a big one for me. You know, I want to make a mark. You know, that song, I want to give my life for someone who wants to last forever. You know, who I delight to do your will. Well, I sometimes feel that song, I don't want to criticize songs here particularly, but it can really feed into just personal ambition. I want to give my life for something last forever. What if God wants you to give your life for something that lasts forever for him, but isn't going to leave a monument for you? That may be his will. I delight to do your will, really? Is that, can we really say that's our delight? And related to that, I tend to be an activist. So I like to do stuff. And therefore, what I would focus on is keeping busy rather than keeping close to God. Activity over virtue. And if we're overtired, as I'm often overtired, that can lead to time wasting. It really can. So, okay, here goes a confession. I've spent 3 months of my life playing online chess, and I'm really bad. I don't get any better. So, but I mean, I'm not saying it's a wrong thing to do, it's one of my little pleasures, but it's also one of those things I sometimes do when I'm overtired, and it doesn't make me unovertired, because in the creation, you've got work and cessation, okay? Work and cessation. equaling rest. Now we've got work, rest, and play, right? So you've got a threefold division of reality, and we can often equate play with rest, but it's not the same thing at all. So, you know, people can be tired because they've been playing computer games late and so on, and you needed to do something to unwind from the stressful life you were in. And let's face it, whatever those pastoral conversations were, they were really quite difficult and so on. So you go and unwind. But that's, of course, where the temptation can really hit. And so that's certainly something I'm absolutely, I'm human. And, you know, energy drains. Yeah, so I've been helped recently with the thought of one set of character profiles that we use now sometimes when we're taking on staff. And they actually look at things that give you energy and things that take your energy away. And one of the things you've got to realize is in longer term, you've got to have things that fill up your energy as much as the amount of energy you're giving out. You can be net losing energy for a limited amount of time, but if you sustain that, well, you can't sustain that long term. There comes a point when, as with, you know, the smoker who can smoke all of their life until a particular point when suddenly they hit a health crisis, and they're wondering, well, I'm only doing the same as I was doing the day before and the day before and the day before that. You know, but gradually they've hit this line where consequences are going to come in. And so that's where part of my burnout was related to that. If I'm energized by discovering things, research, it could be that it's indulgent and that I'm just saying that's my calling because I like it. But it could also be a certain way, the way God's built me. And you don't want to... You've got to be careful with this because, you know, people can say, I'm made this way, therefore I have to do this, yeah? And I don't want to work from feeling to calling, okay? Sometimes we're called to do things that we don't feel like doing. But that's an area where having often get drained of energy, you need to think about what will give you energy back. Now, going to employing people, I've made some mistakes in this. Not making so many mistakes now because other people are doing the actual employing and so on. So yes, I have given people jobs, failing to interview. Always have an interview. Just make sure there's a formality to that. And I've ignored warning signs in references or misgivings of others. Can think of a time when, you know, I really had set my heart on having a particular person on the team, and, you know, reference, yeah, it didn't come through. I think, what's wrong with the referee? I mean, like, surely they've got some issue there, and actually they were right. So trying to control other people's futures, this is a big danger for me, where, you know, we do have some grant money, we have some ability to encourage people to do this form of scholarship or not. And we actually, part of our vision is to raise up evangelical Bible scholars. So the danger is that then we could be looking for people. God hasn't called to do that. And we could be trying to get them into this calling. And we've got various ways of shoehorning people into this calling. We've got incentive structures. And actually, that's not what they should be doing. And I've certainly have done that, and it doesn't work out well. Sometimes someone comes on board for a little bit and they say, actually, this is just not my calling. And often one of the issues there is lack of prayer on my part. You wake up in the morning and think, I know how to do this job. We don't. We don't know what God's calling us to do today. We know what we did yesterday. We don't know what God's calling us to do today. Trying to replicate ourselves. Leaders have a huge impact on the organizational culture, and people often want to emulate them in some ways. And that, you know, that can include, you know, all sorts of things that are just quirky habits that aren't things of God. Also, then underappreciating people that you have on the team, just not valuing people, not saying thank you often enough, allowing people within a team to get isolated. You know, some people are more closely connected in the team, and then there are people who just aren't so closely connected, and you can just allow that to develop, and it's not good. And then a couple of related mistakes are over and under paying. Now, I try not to get involved much in pay nowadays. Again, I have other people and sometimes external reviews looking at that sort of thing. I want to talk to you about the evil of overpaying. Overpaying is quite an evil thing, actually. I know it doesn't necessarily sound evil because people can seem very happy at first. But one of the things that it does is it creates these things like golden handcuffs, where someone can't go on and fulfill their calling, or they believe they can't go on and fulfill their calling because they're getting a better deal currently with you, or people, or they know that they couldn't get that elsewhere. So that's where I think making sure that on pay decisions you've got people who really know these sorts of things, don't just guess at numbers. There are different criteria people can use for paying, but I've had situations where we've actually had people who would have been able to move on more quickly. It would have been better for them if we hadn't overpaid. Likewise, underpaying, we've lost people, you know, who just said, look, you know, I put in the time. I wasn't able to make ends meet. I mean, I really like your organization, but just this couldn't work. Not that you can tailor pay by people's need, but that's been a mistake. Being too flexible. I had an intern, I was given a really good piece of advice after having one intern, which is always have four, because then they can entertain each other. And, you know, they sort of create a sort of culture amongst themselves. If you've just got one, they can feel really isolated because they're often the most junior in the organization. And with this particular intern, I just wanted certain work done and was over-flexible on hours. So I said, yeah, I don't mind when you do it, just come and do the hours. Said person got engaged. And his fiancée was doing a degree elsewhere. And she said, well, your days are flexible. So that means, you know, you'll be able to come and see me after my lecture ends on this particular day, and so on. And very soon, he had no way of saying no to that. Now, they're happily married, it's all great. But even though he was hoping initially to stay with us for a year, ended up leaving halfway through the year because I think major mistake was simply being too flexible. We said, this is the package, this is what you have to do, we need you in the office at 9 o'clock, then it would have been a lot easier for him to do his work than being told, I don't mind when you do it, and so on. And particularly with junior members of staff, that can be an issue. Now, we actually have quite a bit of flexibility with a number of people at work. You know, if you need to take an afternoon off on Friday and so on, there are all sorts of ways we can try and be flexible. I'm all for that. That's great. But it's having a firm framework and then the flexibility. But the biggest mistakes for everything, other than, I think, is probably cowardice. I mean, it's hard to say what are the biggest mistakes, because I just think there are so many things that if I'd just been more prayerful and close to God, you know, what would have been otherwise. But I think trying to lead an academic organization and also being someone who likes to be liked, that can just shape the way you profile the message, the way you speak on issues, where you can just dovetail what you want to what you think the desired effect will be. You're trying to get people to like your organization and just overall trying to be too popular. And it's hard to know what would be the case if we had been a little bit more forthright, if that makes sense. You know, it's one of those things I think academics that we really struggle with, the whole question of boldness and bravery. And so that, I think, is may seem a bit intangible, but that is what I think maybe my biggest mistake. But I'm also maybe not the person to judge. Well, just to finish with God's grace. God's been very gracious to us. We've got a happy team. And yeah, as I say, donors from nowhere. Sometimes discovery is handed on a plate. God's grace is also shown in difficulty. So yes, we've had good times, but God would be no less gracious if we were not having a good time right now. So I think we've got, you know, 25 staff members and basically happy team. And that's a good thing.